This is the In Focus podcast from The Hindu.
Hello and welcome to The Hindu's In Focus podcast. I'm Kunal Shankar, The Hindu's deputy business editor and your host for this episode. The 164-member World Trade Organization holds what it calls a ministerial conference, a once-in-2-years meeting of all its member countries to discuss, negotiate, and address global trade rules. WTO's 13th Ministerial Conference, or MC13, took place in Abu Dhabi in late February this year, but it failed to make headway on key agenda items. Such failures in negotiations have come to plague the WTO lately, and yet despite these failures, outcomes are often touted as major victories by member countries. Like in India's case, where Union Commerce Minister Piyush Goyal claimed a win for the country's farmers when India's position on demanding sovereignty over public stockholding of food and providing largely artisanal fishing nations subsidies for fisheries failed to reach consensus. Two more demands of developing countries. The first, lifting the moratorium on levying customs duty on e-commerce. And second, a reconstitution of the WTO's dispute settlement appellate body remained unresolved as well. And yet, why are these key wins for developing nations? To discuss this, I have with me Ranja Sengupta from the global nonprofit Third World Network. Ranja, welcome to the Hindus in Focus podcast. Could we start with a brief description of your work and your role at WTO's ministerial conferences?
I work as a senior researcher. I'm with the Third World Network. Third World Network, it's a research organization, non-profit organization. We are headquartered in Malaysia, but we have offices all over the world. And we kind of monitor a lot of the global policy negotiations between governments in key areas of development. And our approach is, we work from a perspective of developing countries and least developed countries. And our objective is, you know, it's a public interest organization which tries to protect developing country interests, development objectives, and the policy space for meeting development objectives in developing countries and LDCs. So we work in a number of areas. I work, for example, on international trade and investment policy, but we also have programs, say, on climate change, on intellectual property rights, on global finance, on sustainable agriculture, and so on. So our work is we monitor global policy negotiations between governments in, you know, these international institutions and intergovernmental spaces. But our work and research is, on the one hand, we try to give inputs to developing country and LDC governments if they want it, that is. And then we also work on the other hand with, you know, other civil society organizations, with grassroots organizations, trying to kind of build like a connection between these two extremes. You know, often information doesn't go from one end to the other. So we are kind of in between, trying to kind of support, you know, these countries and also trying to ensure that interests of those who are, you know, on the ground, working at the grassroots level, those concerns are also taken on board in these negotiations. So that's the kind of work we do.
Right. So great. That's a perfect introduction for the conversation that we're going to have. And you have just returned from Abu Dhabi, where the World Trade Organization's 13th Ministerial Conference, which happens every 2 years, just concluded. And from the looks of it, it appears to have been a rather acrimonious and long-winded set of conversations. So why don't you begin with telling us just what happened, particularly in the backdrop of some of developing world's key demands, which India seems to have sort of voiced, which are also indeed India's own demands, in particular when it comes to food security and agriculture more broadly. So, and I know that your expertise is in that area. So if you can expand on the context of how we entered these negotiations and what you thought was India's positions.
So as you very rightly said, Kunal, that this 13th ministerial conference, which took place in Abu Dhabi between 26th and 29th of February, and then it got extended by a day. So it ended on the 1st of March, and it was acrimonious, but that is something we have come to expect over the, you know, last many ministerials of the World Trade Organization, because, you know, increasingly there has been this divide between developed countries and developing countries. And the WTO was, you know, controlled and in a way almost set up at the initiative of developed countries. But increasingly developing countries, and India definitely one of the important ones, they have found a voice and they've, you know, try to organize themselves better. And they are actually starting to articulate their demands. And, you know, this is, and that's why we see over many ministerials that there are a lot of differences between what developed countries have been pushing in the WTO and what developing countries were, in fact, told. They were told, you know, when they joined the WTO and when it was set up in 1995, that their development concerns will be met and they would be given flexibilities to actually, so they did not have to liberalize at the same pace as the developed countries would, but they were promised that, you know, you will get access to markets in developed countries and so on. And the most important thing, they were told that you will get, firstly, same access to our markets. So all WTO member states, you know, it's an underlying principle, a very key principle of the WTO. It's called the MFN, the most favored nation, that all members are treated alike. So no member, if tomorrow one country doesn't like you, they cannot suddenly take their markets away. So it's like the level playing field it was supposed to be in terms of market access. So developing countries were told that, you know, you will get market into developed country markets and you can come and sell us your products, but we will also give you time to catch up, time to develop. So they were promised special and differential treatment. So they would get, you know, longer time to implement the commitments, or they did not have to liberalize as much as the developed countries would, or in terms of, you know, WTO addresses subsidies. Subsidies are supposed to be trade distorting. So a lot of the WTO agreements talk about cuts in subsidies, but then developing countries were supposed to not cut so much as the developed countries. So these were the original promises. But as I was saying, you know, over the history of the WTO, we've seen this divide grow and a lot of these promises have not been met. So coming to Abu Dhabi, this time, of course, agriculture, as you said, has been one of the key issues and I would say one of the major areas of conflict since 1995, when the WTO was born. And the reason is that, you know, developing countries were actually told that we know that agriculture is a major area of interest for you. Because, you know, most developing countries, LDCs, most of our population, our, you know, the working population is in agriculture. It's the largest sector, most important and kind of oldest sector, right? So they were told that, yes, you have interest, we know, in agricultural exports. And developed countries at that time gave huge subsidies, actually. So they were told that, oh, you come in, you bring agriculture under the WTO umbrella. And the main job that we will do is discipline these Western subsidies. So you get a level playing field and you can actually then, you know, use your agriculture sector to kind of generate income and to meet your own food security needs, but also access global markets. But we have seen that the most contentious issue has been that the huge subsidies given by Western countries, US, European Union, Japan, Switzerland, Canada, these simply have not been disciplined. But for a long time, I would say since 2012, this issue has been coming to the fore that, you know, for example, India gives MSP, right? The minimum support price to farmers. And we know how kind of lot of kind of farmers protests around it. But for farmers in India, it's been a major tool that kind of guarantees them this minimum price for our PDS, for government procurement program. And that government gives them an assurance that, yes, I will buy it from you at, and I'll cover your cost, right? So there is a subsidy involved there, that if the farmers are not getting the good enough price, which, and we've seen that happen, right? Like over the last like 20 years, often farmer, the prices they are getting in the market, it's not, and their costs are going so high that it's not enough to cover their costs. Then this price is a very important signaling mechanism that, yes, we will buy it from you at this price. We will cover your cost and we will give you a bit of profit. And therefore, you can continue to produce. So you can imagine that this is important not only for ensuring livelihoods and continuation of production. It is very important for running the PDAs. If they could not buy from farmers, you know, if farmers were just selling outside or exporting everything, say, then governments, frankly, would not be able to even run these public food programs. But the problem is this subsidy given to producers. So the subsidy that goes to consumers, it's okay by WTO rules. But the subsidy given to producers is seen as trade distorting. And so this subsidy, and it's not only India, you know, which buys from farmers for such public food programs. There are many developing countries, Indonesia, Kenya, Zimbabwe, Turkey, Tunisia, like many countries across the world use such programs, right? So the thing is, but this subsidy, now the WTO rules tell you that these subsidies, which are trade distorting subsidies, should be only for developing countries 10% of value of production in a year. Now the thing is, and one interesting thing, I mean, I hope it's not seen to be too technical, but it's very important to understand this point, that by some crazy WTO rule, when it was agreed, you know, in the Agreement of Agriculture in 1995, this subsidy is compared not to current global prices, but to a fixed 86-88 price, which is called the external reference price. So I'm just giving you a hypothetical example, right? So if rice, say, just for example, if it was 3 rupees per kg in 86-88, say current global prices are 22, and say government is giving MSP of 24. So the subsidy is only 2 rupees per kg. But when you compare it with the 86-88 price, it's actually, it becomes 21 rupees per kg. So because of this peculiar way of calculation, India and some other countries have been breaching this limit. So since 2012, 2013, since the days of the Bali ministerial, they've been saying that this subsidy for developing countries and LDCs, because these are essential for supporting livelihoods and production and therefore critical for food security, these they should be able to give even if they breach that limit. And this fight has been going on. They got something called a peace clause that, okay, even if they breach, they will not be taken to the dispute, you know, in the WTO. Because members can, if you are supposed to, if you have so-called violated rules, any country, then any other member can take you to the dispute.
Yeah.
So this was agreed, but this peace clause has so many conditions and some of them are very vague. So if you don't exactly know what the condition is, it's very difficult to meet it or not meet it, right? So some things say it, you should not distort trade, or such subsidies should not adversely affect food security of other countries. But it's not clear, is it only that you should not export or you should not sell from these in domestic market? What's the linkage? What are you not supposed to do? That's not clear. And then on the other hand, it's limited only to programs which are, you know, before, which existed before 2013. It does not extend to all products. You know, our farmers are asking that it should be extended to 24 products now, right? This covers only 6 traditional staples, so on. So this has been limited, but developing countries were promised that, okay, this is an interim solution. You will get a permanent solution by 2017. But since then, US, but also agricultural exporters, and I would say most of the developed countries have completely blocked it. And every ministerial, India and other developing countries and LDCs have been saying, we need the permanent solution. So this time, there was a lot of pressure put by developing countries. And let me also add here that in 2022, 80 countries, so this is the G33 group of developing countries, the African group of 44 African countries, and the ACP, Africa, Caribbean and Pacific group, together 80 countries submitted a proposal in 2022 saying this is the, you know, proposal on the permanent solution. which would make it user-friendly, but which also had safeguards. But the developed countries, they have refused to even discuss. It simply has not been discussed in this over, like, you know, 1 year. So basically, even this time, India put a lot of pressure till the end. It's, you know, of critical interest for India, but it simply was not given. They blocked it till the last moment. India also said, please update the external reference price. This was part of that joint proposal, but even this was simply refused, and therefore the agriculture talks broke down. So this was a critical issue. This was a, you know, long promised solution. But on the other hand, it's interesting, they are turning around, and every ministerial, they will blame India and other developing countries, especially India, saying that you blocked the talks. But the developed countries and also this agriculture exporters group, which is called the Keynes group at the WTO, they have repeatedly, they are the ones who have actually blocked. So agriculture was a critical issue, and the other issue is fisheries subsidies.
Right. So I think you've given us a lot of information and also quite a lot to unpack. So one thing I firstly wanted to understand, so when you said extend the external price, you mean the price at which the country can sell at the international market, or did you mean?
No, I mean the fixed external reference price, which is this 86-88 price, right? Yes, on the basis of which the subsidies are supposed to be calculated. So the proposal suggested that it could be the average of last 3 years' price. You know, you peg it to global price, and then we'll know what the real situation is.
Which allows for inflation to be countered into and price rise and all other.
Yes, exactly. So you can either peg it to global price, or you can put in a formula which then accounts for inflation, but they refuse to do even that. So no wonder that the agricultural talks broke down.
So in this backdrop, Ranja, that you just mentioned, it's interesting because the commerce minister who led the delegation, the Indian delegation in Abu Dhabi, a couple of days ago sort of hailed the talks as a success for India. And he, said he was satisfied, after the talks, at the conclusion of the talks. So how do you view the government's position, especially when you say that the talks on agriculture failed?
Yes, exactly. I mean, see, it's interesting that you're mentioning that. In terms of actual deliverable, of course, it failed, the agricultural talk, and which was the most important kind of demand from India, right? It was very important for India. So that way it's failed. And there was also apart from this permanent solution, there was a general document on agriculture, which is like, there's always this outcome on agriculture, which is kind of agreed by all the member states, every ministerial. And there we have also other areas of demand other than the permanent solution on public stock holding, this MSP issue. But also we had some demand related to a special safeguard mechanism. Then cotton subsidies given, for example, by the US, which has really affected cotton farmers in India and in Africa and so on. So the thing is, we would have wanted then deadlines for the next ministerial, that at least they would be delivered by the next ministerial, right, in 2026. But the thing is that there are demands, you know, also coming from the other side. They want more tariff liberalization. They want us not to put up, you remember, export restrictions was an important issue. India has put up export restrictions to ensure domestic food security. Many other countries use, so that the agricultural exporters do not like. So they also want more transparency and so on. So the problem was that they wanted hard deadlines also for their issues. Whereas the mandates for the permanent solution, for the special safeguard mechanism, for cotton subsidies, these issues which are of critical interest for developing countries, these have very strong mandates reaffirmed in the Nairobi Ministerial of 2015. But so it was kind of like a head-to-head thing. So if we wanted deadlines for our issues, then there would be deadlines we would have to give for their issues. So in a way, it is good, I would say, though the agricultural talks are a failure and we did not get the permanent solution, but at least we did not sign on to, you know, deadlines on issues which are of not in our interest. So therefore, the fact that the agriculture talks actually got jammed is a better solution than getting a kind of adverse outcome. So that I would say, and also on fisheries. So the other issue is fisheries, right?
Yeah. So let me just finish this point. So basically the commerce minister, so that's setting a really low bar, isn't it? I guess it's a low bar given the history that you just like very in detail gave us, which is that we have been at loggerheads with the developed nations for a while about the extent of subsidies that we can provide our farmers and our agriculture, the agriculture sector. And given that our demands have not been met, at least a non-adverse demand is better than not having met anything at all. So that's really what the minister is calling a success, not so much a concession given by the.
Exactly. It is not exactly a positive outcome. It's not a positive instrument that India has managed to secure. It's more that but this is where we are in the WTO agreement. You know, like I have worked my organization is a civil society organization. I have worked for a long time on trade policy. And for us, in a way, we are breathing a sigh of relief if it's not an adverse agreement. But that means you can see that the WTO is not delivering anything for us. We are happy. And for years, this permanent solution was the only positive agenda for developing countries on the table. On everything else, the agenda itself is against their interest, and they have been trying to fight it. But the agriculture one is the only positive agenda. But we are seeing the way it is blocked. There is nothing to be, it seemed, you know, there's nothing anymore that developing countries hope to gain from WTO, and our best gain from it is, oh, I did not lose anything, you know?
Right. So, okay, if I come back to some of the statements that the minister made during the talks, it was interesting that he raised issues like the point that, you know, WTO is a strictly a trade body that must not give room for conversations on, say, labor, on decarbonization and climate change, and on human rights, etc. Is that coming from the point that there is now an increasing emphasis on supply chain decarbonization and the countries, like, for instance, the EU carbon tax and other nations bringing in certain ways where they, you know, for their own domestic audiences and as well as for their commitments at COPs, try and show that they are taking measures on sustainability. Is that based on a worry that it is going to be creeping into the World Trade Organization conversations, or is that because there is...
It's already creeping in. Yes, you are right. It's already creeping in. And this agenda, so there is this agenda coming in on trade and environment, apparently to meet, you know, the commitments of the Paris Agreement and so on. And also, you know, these issues such as gender, like trade and women's rights and labor has been, of course, a very old issue in the WTO. And
when you say Paris Agreement, you mean COP 2015 Paris Agreement, right? Okay,
right.
Yeah,
go ahead. Yeah. Yes, exactly, on climate change. So these issues have been coming in, but I think the position of most developing countries and least developed countries have been that there is, for example, the UNFCCC to discuss climate-related, environment-related issues. Let's discuss it there. I think the worry for them is that these non-trade issues are becoming non-tariff barriers. You know, the labor discussion that came into the WTO, but developing countries didn't want it because they knew that these would be used against them as conditionalities, as standard setting, which would actually make them uncompetitive. And we see kind of like a similar framework is coming in now. So I have worked, you know, for a long time on trade and gender. And we know a lot of these trade agreements have been creating adverse impact on women's rights. But for example, the way the AOA has functioned, it has allowed, you know, subsidize agricultural products from Western countries to come into developing country markets and destroyed farmers' livelihoods, especially small farmers, women farmers' livelihoods, their access to seeds through the intellectual property rights, or women already have, you know, like a skewed access, say, on health and access to medicine. But the TRIPS agreement has made medicine so expensive that it has skewed the access against women even more. So there are these problems of trade agreements. But the thing is, the moment these issues are, and we know that the trade agreements have, the trade-related agreement on intellectual property rights at the WTO, which has, you know, kind of advanced patenting on medicines, I mean, on other products, even on medicines, and medicine prices have increased worldwide across the countries which had to implement the TRIPS agreement. So there are these broad adverse development impacts of many of the WTO agreements, but now also the bilateral free trade agreements. And as I was saying, even on environment, many of these investment agreements, you know, India had many of these investment treaties, and we also have investment provisions under the trade agreements. They have actually prevented governments from taking climate measures, from environmental conservation. So the trade agreements are definitely having an impact on environment and social dimensions. Problem is, when you're bringing it into the WTO, what is the framework? The worry is the way the developed countries are bringing in, for example, environment. It is coming in as a standard. And you have seen the unilateral measures that the EU has used, right? The CBAM, etc., the Deforestation Act. These are imposing a cost on developing country exports at the border. And not only that, this means that actually this will make it easier for developed country products, so-called, you know, they had this agreement on environment goods and services. So the idea is, you do not meet the standards. They are the ones producing these goods and services, and they will come and sell it to us. So we need not develop these products. We will not be able to develop these products. So as we move to a greener economy, and when we need to use more and more, you know, more environment-friendly goods and services, our producers will not be the ones producing them. We are supposed to import everything from them. So in a way, it is laying down standards and conditionalities that kicks our producers out of the production pathways. And I think developing countries, I mean, whoever, we work with a lot of missions in Geneva, you know, around the WTO, and they are very, very concerned that the way it is coming in, it is not addressing substantive issues in these agreements. You know, like they are not addressing, for example, why small farmers have been harmed and why the agreement on agriculture has ensured that subsidized products have come from the West to, you know, kick out small farmers out of production. Why the TRIPS agreement has increased medicine prices and that has adversely affected the poor across our countries and they do not have healthcare. They are not interested in addressing these. They are bringing it in a very specific way to ensure commercial advantage. And I think the space is problematic because WTO was created for, you know, trade negotiations, very hardcore commercial bargaining. If you bring in social issues, they have the risk of turning bad, you know, and you do not get outcomes which are being promised, but you actually get commercially adverse outcomes for our producers and, you know, for their incomes and our development pathways.
Right. So now coming to the question that you began speaking about, which is fisheries. India, of course, is a huge, it has a huge coastline. There are several communities, millions of members of communities dependent on fishing. And I believe from our conversation earlier, you think that that has also been either an adverse outcome or at least not a satisfactory outcome. If you can expand on what the talks were and what the outcome was.
Yeah, so I would not say it's a satisfactory outcome. See, the objective of these, the fishery subsidies negotiations, it started actually in 2001. It's quite old. I mean, the history is quite old. Originally, it was also similar to the agriculture subsidies. These subsidies were supposed to be cut for, because they were seen as trade distorting. But then the discussion moved to environment. So the objective was the conservation of marine resources. We know that because of massive industrial scale fishing, mainly by the developed countries, but also by some developing countries, which have the capacity, they have large ships, they have the technology. So they have the capacity to go
basically deep sea fishing.
Deep sea fishing, distant water fishing, they are fishing also in other countries' waters. And therefore, they have fished so much that fish stocks are at really dangerous levels, which also means that our small fishers will not get fish to even maintain livelihoods and their own food security. So this was the objective. And you know, the SDG Sustainable Development Goal, target 14.6, for this purpose, for marine conservation, it said that WTO should discipline fisheries subsidies and special and differential treatment. Remember, I told you that this was supposed to be the flexibilities for developing countries and LDCs, because they cannot match, you know, the commitments by developed countries. They need more kind of, you know, leniency. So this was supposed to be a very integral part of the negotiations. But right from the beginning, we have seen that those who are responsible, you know, those who really do this industrial scale fishing and those who have also subsidized historically, they have refused to take the responsibility. So last year, a partial agreement was signed, but the most contentious part, which were the subsidies that supposedly contribute to overcapacity and overfishing. Now, these kind of subsidies are like the general subsidies, infrastructure subsidies, even to develop your boats, your harbor, everything. So these are very important for developing countries, because our fisheries sector are still backward. And as you said, for example, in India, I think that we have more than 4 million fishers and basically small scale fishers who are dependent. And that future policy pathway has to be kept open for them, right? But India and all these countries joined the negotiation on the agreement. But this time, these OCOF, this overcapacity, overfishing subsidies were being negotiated. But I will just quickly sum for you what we had at, you know, during MC13, leading up to MC13. On the one hand, the disciplines for large-scale fishing was, I mean, abominably weak. I mean, shockingly weak, right? Because there was this... So all these subsidies, there's a list, it's supposed to be disciplined. But if a country can show that they are fishing sustainably, and there are some indicators and you have to do a notification, if they can show that, they can continue to subsidize. Now, this is the biggest loophole, because just to do this notification, for example, measuring fish stocks, developing countries don't have such capacity. They don't have the monitoring mechanism. These are expensive. So the developed countries, they have these mechanisms. They can make the notification. They can then easily escape the rules. But developing countries cannot. So, but after a lot of discussion, the rules therefore gave this big escape clause to those who are actually responsible, and even distant water fishing, which is seen to be definitely unsustainable fishing, large-scale fishing, industrial-scale fishing. But till the last moment, on the 29th, some text came up. And this was like, they already had very weak language on disciplines on distant water fishing, and it had become even weaker. Like there was nothing there, but developing countries, including India, India is still more capable, but even India would not be able to make these notifications and use that loophole. On the other hand, yes, the second part of the agreement was special and differential treatment. So India had wanted 25 years transition. Not only India, many developing countries were standing behind them. And also full exemption for small-scale fishers. You cannot imagine how much resistance these two clauses kind of faced, even till the last moment when, after a lot of fight, developing countries managed to get full exemption up to the exclusive economic zone, which is 200 nautical miles, and the UN Convention on the Law of the Seas gives countries right up to their EEZ. So they had been saying that at least our subsidies for small-scale fishers should be exempt till EEZ. They were not getting it. Only last minute they got it. But you know what was the condition? That they should not be significantly commercial. Now, nobody knows what's significantly commercial, which means either they have to eat the fish themselves or they have to put it back in the sea. They cannot be commercial. They do not have the right to earn livelihoods from fishing. So it was that ridiculous. And therefore, many other countries we know were very unhappy. India also was unhappy. India blocked it, said no. And because India is quite a strong country with a strong voice, it has the ability to block our agreements. So I would say, and it's not over, right? So it will be negotiated. Maybe in next ministerial, we'll see an agreement. But what we had on the table was so unfair and so unbalanced that for the time being, and again, we are back to that same thing that, you know, no agreement, like a bad agreement. The best we can do is just to stall a bad agreement because we have no hope, it seems, that of getting anything good from the WTO.
Right, right. Wow. So that's a rather low bar to set for, you know, for our talks when we went in. Finally, there was one more point that India sort of brought to the table this time, which is taxing digital commerce. And it appeared that developing countries were very vociferously against the move. And that also has a moratorium, a sort of a peace clause, the way you defined, agriculture subsidies earlier. What was the outcome on that and what were the negotiations like?
Yeah, so this has been for a long time. What happened is these are the border taxes which were never imposed. So, for example, when we download a game or an ebook, right? These are goods basically, but they are moving digitally. So it's not a physical. Physically, they are not coming in. If they had come in physically, there would be an import duty on them. But when they are coming in online, there is no duty. There is no tax at the border on these, right? But in WTO, there is this kind of tacit agreement, every ministerial. So therefore, it's for 2 years, every 2 years. Developing countries agree not to impose any tax on this e-commerce, right? On this electronic transmission.
Like what you just described. So it can be like you said, the use of an app.
Or a game download, whatever,
a video,
right?
Game which is downloaded. Or could it also be something that we've bought on Amazon and it's been shipped? But then that would be,
that's
to cross.
Physical. That is physical. Anything that's not physical, that's completely online.
Only digital. That's right. Okay.
Yeah, digital. The product itself is a digital product, right? So it does not need a physical.
So the purchase
movement.
Of any software for that matter.
Software, yes.
It could be Adobe or it could be the recording platform that we're on now, right? Music, right?
Yes. So so these kind of products, the idea was every 2 years, we will not, developing countries agreed not to impose a duty. But and in exchange, they would be getting what is called the TRIPS non-violation complaint. So in the sense, if any country violates the TRIPS agreement, they can be taken to dispute. So the idea was they will not be taken to dispute, right? Now, the thing is, so this moratorium, and it had been renewed for many times, but increasingly developing countries are realizing that they are actually losing because this business is growing like anything. Frankly, very soon it will probably overtake any physical, physical movement of goods.
It probably already has data in India is now so cheap and people actually download apps. The data revolution has led to a lot of people having, smartphones and people download apps every
Absolutely.
Day. I mean, yeah.
And now, you know, with 3D printer, for example, you can just get the design online and you download it and you print it here. Very soon, we will not even have probably physical movement of goods. So this is like huge and growing business. And UNCTAD, for example, there's an UNCTAD study which estimates that developing countries have been losing billions of dollars. India, I think this estimate was for 2020, and India's potential revenue loss is $1.4 billion from this. Okay. One is this is huge revenue loss. Second thing is also it's a industrial policy space issue. Since these products can now have started to grow in our countries, we would like to give them that policy protection for some time so that these grow, right? Because these are now coming mainly from the north. So with these dynamics kind of getting amplified. Developing countries, even in last ministerial, if you remember, they had said that, no, we will not give this. And we are basically almost giving it away for free. So they said, no, we will not give this. We want, and also that, you know, which are these products? There needs to be more clarity. So last time, finally, it went through. This time, India, and interestingly, not only India, Indonesia, South Africa, Brazil, Namibia, and one, two other countries, they all said no, that we will not renew this. So, but the thing is, at the last moment, India, for some reason, and India, I think, was wanting to at least get the permanent solution in exchange, right? Because we clearly understand that in the harsh WTO negotiation space, if you do not, you know, you need to do always these trade-offs. So maybe India had hoped to get the
permanent solution. You have to have give and take. You have to decide on something and like let go elsewhere.
Yeah, you have to give. But we have already given. Actually, for the permanent solution, we have India agreed. India and all developing countries agreed to sign on to the trade facilitation agreement in the Bali ministerial in 2013. They only got that peace clause, remember, which is only an interim clause. But they have signed on to a permanent trade facilitation agreement, but they still didn't get the permanent solution. This time, maybe that India had expected that would be the trade-off. They did not get the permanent solution, but somehow India agreed to sign on to this e-commerce, this moratorium again, but only for 2 years. So the agreement is that it will lapse. So the understanding, the language is somehow seems to indicate that it is going to. So they are, this is the last 2 years that the membership will get it. After in the next ministerial in 2026, this will terminate. Along with that, there is an e-commerce work program that will, that's supposed to discuss some of these issues in a multilateral space, right? Not in the, there is also an e-commerce plurilateral, which is being pushed mainly by developed countries. It is not that. The multilateral discussion, these will end in the next ministerial. So it has been renewed, but renewed only for what it seems like the last 2 years.
Another last 2 years, right, right.
But I wanted to, Kunal, maybe, I mean, I've talked very dismally, but I also wanted to say that we also work on the bilateral trade agreements, the free trade agreements, right? And there we know that the Northern Agenda, like, you know, very aggressive interest of developed countries, they have, because they've moved it beyond WTO. These free trade agreements are WTO plus plus, and many issues are coming in, including e-commerce, digital and investment and many things. So, and also the TRIPS agreement, these have, they at least propose commitments on intellectual property rights, which go way beyond the TRIPS agreement. So overall, I still would say that the WTO or the multilateral trade space remains very important. And India is committed, it says, to multilateral trade negotiation, though India is actually signing on and engaging in massive number of free trade agreements. But still, India is committed to the WTO space. And I think the importance of the multilateral space is still remains critical, though, as I said, you know, it's the WTO's performance has been dismal. It has not been able to deliver anything positive. You know, well, the only thing, you know, when our best bet is, oh, nothing bad happened in this ministerial, thank God, then you know how dismal, the very low bar. But in spite of that, I would say that we do, whether it's the WTO or wherever, we multilateral trade rules, fair and equitable trade rules, remain much better than bilateral. That's what we've seen from the real experience. But the WTO has to become much more fair, much more inclusive, and absolutely take seriously the concerns of developing countries and LDCs. It simply has to deliver on those promises, on those mandates, you know, because if it keeps blocking, then agriculture, for one, I mean, this will, it will never see a resolution. And we know how critical its agricultural trade rules are to have fair and, you know, kind of well-functioning global agricultural markets. And WTO has blocked it to a large extent. So, yeah, I mean, the importance of having a fair and equitable, a just multilateral trade institution, I mean, it can't be underlined enough.
You know, the only thing what was interesting for me as an observer watching the WTO talks going on in parallel, when the farmers in India are protesting, seeking the legalizing of, you know, minimum support price for 26 commodities that they have been asking for is that on the one hand, at the global level, at the World Trade Organization level, India is very hell-bent on getting a sort of sovereignty, if you will, to what to our agriculture policies, to how much we decide on what we provide as subsidies or not. But at home, we are unwilling to concede the farmers' demands.
Exactly. I mean, we have seen this dichotomy for a long time. Part of the reason could be that the WTO rules as they stand ties up the government's hands. I mean, India, you know, has used this peace clause 3 times and it has been asked questions, a lot of questions by other members, and it can be taken to dispute. But at the same time, you are very right. We have seen this very kind of almost diametrically opposite stance sometimes, I mean, in domestic policy making and in the WTO. But as I said, like for India, there is no option. I mean, it's very important that they take the WTO negotiations very seriously, which they do. I must acknowledge that the government has pushed, like this time they pushed till the end and they did not kind of agree to anything, like a lopsided thing. We were worried that maybe some half-baked agreement or half-baked permanent solution could be agreed, but they did not agree to anything like that. They were not even offered anything good. And we are hearing, I mean, for the government, and we know from the farmers' protests how critical MSP is for them. They have made it very, very clear. And therefore, I think this is the only option to just push and to ensure that they get what is their right, because it was promised. And we know that the Western subsidies are like huge and they have continued. Many developed countries have, you know, fixed additional subsidy entitlements. Like US has $19 billion. Japan has $36 billion. These are just extra that they have managed to kind of get for themselves. So they can give huge subsidies. The whole subsidies rules are very unfair. And it's the minimum that we will get the permanent solution. I do hope the government will be, you know, committed to this and they will simply push this through in the next ministerial. And then they really have to explore how to build alliance with other developing countries. As I told you, there's the proposal by 80 countries and the 80 countries held together till the last day of MC13, saying that is their demand, but their proposal has not even been discussed. So how, you know, these countries come together, form a strong alliance and very strategically push this issue will remain to be seen. But yes, it is critical for India.
Right. Well, on that note, thank you so much, Ranja Sengupta, for speaking to us. This has been a rather fruitful conversation and quite a lot of detail for our listeners. Thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, I hope it will be interesting and useful for your listeners. Thanks for having me on, Kunal.
Thank you. Thank you.
In Focus will be back soon with analysis of the biggest news issues. In the meantime, you can find our podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and other platforms. Just search for In Focus by The Hindu. We'll see you soon.